On Sunday, April 1st at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents drummer, composer, and poet William Hooker. Join us as we discuss William Hooker's Migration Suite in preparation for his presentation at Brooklyn's Roulette. That's Sunday, April 1st at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. Listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl's name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. And our guest for this evening is drummer, poet, composer, and band leader, William Hooker. Stay tuned for a lively conversation about William Hooker's project, The Great Migration, which will debut at Roulette in Brooklyn on Thursday, April 5th at 8 p.m. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl, starting now.
Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on. Save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar.
Plenty time pass, fast, so fast. I used to know when mango ripe and ready to pick. I used to wait for guava to turn from a hard green ball. When it yellow and creamy ripe with sun, I'd drag a chair from the gallery, stand up on it, and fill my mouth with the sweet meat right from the tree. Now that was living. I used to know if my grandmother left hand hurting, rain coming. And if she right hand damp, it go be sun in the morning, rain after lunch. Them days, children would sit out in hot sun for what seemed like hours. We didn't know nothing about no tanning lotion, you know. In we house, when it come time for going out, if your skin did real dark and pretty like mine, man, they shining it up with coconut oil so everybody for miles could see you coming. And them nasty old men, they see in your face, the crocodile eye on your little breast you ain't even know you have yet. And if you was little chubby, like the Calypsonian say, they grin getting more wider, is like the bigger, the better, the more, the merrier. Thing was nice though. Thing get hard. So, we pack up we self and we come New York. Well, If you see me in these people country, I have 4 lock on my door, I run in 3 job and I still can't see where the money going. Queens get hard, so I pick up my fast self and move to Chelsea was a place for Sunday brunch, all you could eat and drink for $13.95. Gay, modern, postmodern, and retro. Well, you don't have $2,500. Finder's fee? Sorry, honey, this water closet will be gone by midday. And it was. Chelsea was a place for hard white cocks, stirring pain my black could never fathom. Hard boots, open shirt, pierced nipple, and a little doggy collar fastened to the cock ring. I got tired of walking behind flat ass, weighted down with money, the damn Gucci backpack bumping carelessly in my face. Who father know that one father, who know the other one father, who know the one running the Exxon Corporation? That one is a lesbian Avenger who would proudly use her daddy's platinum card to make bail. I am tired of this privileged, politically correct, fake fucking freedom. Harlem is still a tourist attraction. If you see me in this place, time passed fast, so I had time for sun. Never mind rain. My left hip hurting, but it ain't predicting nothing. I want to hold my friend Letta's hand at water's edge. Transcribe the news waves tell. I want to braid Olga's hair, fuse it into black soil. I want my family back. I want to play dominoes with Donna and Linda, make soup for Keith when he's sick, draw a bush bath for Billy till his fever breaks. I want my family back. I want to sit and rock you, have my hips predict your coming, sit and rock you back to a time when we sought respite in each other's breath. I want my family back, and I am blown away in the loose dust that is this city, this house of confusion, these rooms of deceit we have come to know intimately. I want my family back. In your absence, I am Havana, speaking Spanish to Port-au-Prince. I am Papimento, speaking Wolof to Curacao. The shrill spaces your withdrawn hands leave in my body carries dull knives and cracking trees. At this bewitching hour, I hold out my hands to you. Somehow these empty nights, somehow these empty nights seem the right size for making home. Somehow these empty nights seem the right size for making home. My tongue is heavy with its own lacks, but I hold out my life to you. Cause these days, does pass fast, so fast. These days, does pass fast, so fast. So fast, so
thank you. to be tough. Yeah.
Life's decision. Life's decision.
Life's decision. At this point, our main character in A Father's Law has a fiance that he deserts because of a disease that she has inherited. Through no fault of her own, she can no longer provide for herself. And his decision, the intelligent son, is to leave her deserted.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones. I'm on the line with
William Hooker.
William Hooker, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
Hey, how are you?
Okay.
Well, I remember you. I remember because I think you had a camera.
Yes.
That's Joyce.
I am she. The one who kept putting the camera in your face.
No, that was you. So I feel comfortable already because I know who you are. So what's happening, Joyce?
There's something we really need to talk about. There's an event that's coming up on Thursday, April 5th.
Thursday, April 5th, yeah.
At 8 p.m. at Roulette,
yes.
509 Atlantic Avenue, the great place where the Vision Festival is going to happen this year.
That's right. Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn.
That's right.
Because I'm kind of so excited about it.
So tell us about the migration.
The migration essentially is my interpretation of the 6 million African Americans that moved from the South to the three points in America, that being the West, Chicago, and the Northeast, and thereby changing the history of our country. And it's the largest migration that has ever happened of any group that has not been either starved or forced to move because of execution. And I am dealing with the years 1935 to 1950 specifically, because two of the individuals that are my primary source material for this are still alive, and they raised me. This is undoubtedly the most personal piece I've ever done in my life. And one of the people is Mr. Alton Brooks, who is 97 years old, and Miss Nanny Lampkin, who is 89 years old. It tells their stories. It tells them moving from Alabama and Mississippi and just what happened with them in terms of their perspective and why they left, what it was like when they left, and what it was like when they arrived in their new place, which was in Connecticut. And to do this, I'm using a multidisciplinary method, and I'm dealing with music, dance, images, narratives, and those two as my primary source material, which basically is dealing with not only music, but I think cultural anthropology, which is very important in terms of us reinterpreting our history. If I could tell you the people that I have with me.
Yes, please.
All right, then. I have Ross Moshe on tenor sax. I have Eric Robinson on electronics and images. I have Mara Rosenblum on piano and keys. I have David Soldier on violin and banjo. I have William Parker on bass.
Yay!
I have Ava Mendoza on acoustic guitar. I have Gussi Celestine on dance, and she is one of the narrators.
Okay.
And Jeremy Grosvenor is also one of my narrators. And I am on drum. It's something I'm really excited about, and I think it really interprets what the Great Migration is about. I might have sent you the trailer.
You did send me a trailer, but this is radio, and I'm going to play the sound from the trailer.
The Great Migration was the movement of 6 million African Americans out of the rural southern United States to the urban Northeast, Midwest, and West that occurred between 1916 and 1970. It was stated that this was the largest and most rapid mass internal movement in history, which was not caused by the immediate threat of execution or starvation. For blacks, the migration meant leaving what had always been their economic and social base in America and finding a new one. In the course of a generation, the people of this historic event proved the worldview of the enslavers to be a lie, that the people who were forced into the fields and whipped for learning to read could do more than pick cotton and scrub floors. The Great Migration, which is my next event, was thus a declaration of independence. It moved those who had long been invisible, not just out of the South, but into the light.
I did a trailer at Harvest Works here, and I sent it out to as many people as I could. It's on Facebook and stuff like that, too.
Right.
It tells people.
Now, since this is radio, you've told the basis, the foundation of this presentation.
Yes.
Is there anything else that you believe you can share to entice listeners to come see this visual presentation?
Well, it's very interesting when you look at before the migration, what happened during the migration, the life and times of the migrants in the city and in the country, and you look at the impact of the Great Migration. My images that I chose are all dealing with those aspects of it. I think that for those that need a visual palette, the best thing that I can tell them is if one looks at the struggles of a people, African Americans specifically, and they look at how far we've come from the rural to the urban, from people who were basically dealing with agriculture and left because wanted to better themselves economically as well as just pure terror. One can see that the effect of World War II and us having opportunities to better ourselves and our families was juxtaposed with the Jim Crow era, which made it impossible for people to actually benefit totally from what we had given to this country. And all these things are seen in the images, and I have put the music and the narration along with these images. So as this flows, one can see the three words I think I should use are rage, grief, and transformation. And the images show that. The music definitely shows that. And underneath all of these images, one has what I have created. And the thread that goes through the whole thing is the migration theme, which is a piece that I've written along with all the other musicians that takes different methods of looking at the same melodic structure I'm just really excited because finally this is happening after really thinking about this for about a year. And knowing these two individuals and knowing how important they are to their communities and to my own life. And actually having them there in person as well. So it takes a lot of different facets, and they all come together. I really believe that they all come together. It's enjoyable, and we emerge with a certain strength that is necessary, even though you'll see all the things that have happened, and we come out of it with our fists raised high.
Wow.
There's all people from all different ethnic backgrounds playing with me, interpreting my music in terms of classical music, in terms of post-rock music, free jazz, jazz itself, dealing with hymns, using... Let's say if you look at a black child standing in back of a Model T that's getting ready to come up and you put underneath that going home. These are the kinds of things that I'm using. I just believe that it's a profound experience and it should be all over the place. I really believe that. So I'm trying my best. And thanks to Roulette for actually enabling me to do this and bring all these people together.
Beautiful. Yeah, it's a beautiful space. I really enjoy Roulette. I love the sound there. I love everything about it.
I do too. I do too. I've done a lot of things there. Mm-hmm. And many of my recordings have been made there, actually.
Ah, yes, yes.
Uh-huh.
You mentioned Going Home. Were you referring to that particular selection, Going Home?
Yeah, I'm referring to that selection because right. when I actually was looking at Jacob Lawrence's Migration. Yeah, I went there four times to see it, and it had that kind of an effect on me. And then when I read Isabel Wilkerson's book, that put more of what this is about. And then when I realized that the people that had raised me, these were the people that this was about. And the first thing that came to mind was Alice Coltrane's interpretation of Going Home on Lord of Lords and my meeting her and giving her my very first recording so that she could usher it into the cosmos.
Oh, wow.
That was one of the experiences I've had. It was an eternal experience. I can't begin to tell you what that was like. And also what going home means in terms of it being a traditional spiritual that has been interpreted in so many different ways. And I only mention that as one piece.
Sure.
Because there's a lot of music involved in here. Mm-hmm. So that's the way I look at it. That's the way I interpret this particular piece. Because most of the music really is free jazz. As you know, that's what I do.
Right. And that's what surprised me by your mentioning Going Home. Are there other sort of structured pieces like that included? Or it's primarily free?
Well, the migration theme is a structured piece. And it's a structured piece that has soloists that play on top of the theme itself.
Got it.
Because I thought that it would be very important to keep a thread together as we deal with, like, five or six different events. And so that brings us back to earth, back to earthiness, because this is kind of what Miss Lampkin and Mr. Brooks are about. They're about the earth. They're about survival. They're about us having to do what we had to do to make it. And then when you hear their story, you hear the story of a young girl that at 10 years old, her mother dies and she has to leave at 16 with her brother. I mean, this is deep stuff. Have you ever read Isabel Wilkerson's book?
I was just going to ask you about it. No, I have not. What is the name of that book?
The Warmth of Other Suns.
Okay. I've heard the title. I've just not read
it. Oh, whoa.
Yeah.
It's really, it's like that. I mean, I can't really say anything about it. You pick it up, you start seeing what this is about. And it had an effect on me, a very deep effect on me. So I don't want to get too deep into it because I might start to cry when I think about what people we've known have gone through. It's tough stuff.
Right.
When they come out with compassion and they come out with love and they come out with a caring that oftentimes we take for granted.
Well, I understand your father was part of the migration story.
Yes.
And what is his name?
William James Hooker II. I'm William James Hooker III.
Okay. And I understand also in your story that your father, your brother, and your sister were ministers?
Yes. And they've all were waiting for me to start preaching too, but I told them that I'm preaching in a much different way.
Exactly.
Which I think that they understood. They understood from Toddy L. Dowd to Ascension. They understood, which was cool. Because a lot of people, they don't feel as if there's any sort of, you know, when you start playing the kind of music that many of us play in terms of free jazz and avant-garde music, people just feel as if you're dealing with just sound and noise and dissonance. And until you start to really investigate the music and deal with the history of the music, then you realize just how spiritual this music is.
Right.
And you know what I mean. And you've seen it over and over again. I know. I know that it's a source of nourishment for your soul. I know. Otherwise, you wouldn't even be half the places I see you.
Right.
You'd be like, well, I don't think so. And so you know. So they knew too.
Oh, excellent. I bring that situation up because, well, I guess your father being a minister, that provides another type of migration story. Was he also a minister when he migrated to Connecticut?
No, no. As a matter of fact, he and the person who is my primary source, because I basically studied sociology and political science and anthropology when I went to school. That's what my degrees are in. And when you really look at it, the person that I use as my primary source, because this isn't out of a book. This is a person, you're going to see this person.
Right.
And if you want to ask him questions, you probably could. He'd be, oh, yeah. He still drives. He's 97 years old. And he and my father met when they got here.
Okay.
Because of work situations that were opened up from people from the South to teach them about how to work machinery, etc. And you'll hear his story. And no, he was called to preach when he arrived in the North. And that was quite an experience for us as a family. And we grew in that. We grew in that and we came to understand it really profoundly because at one point he had the largest black congregation in Connecticut.
Wow.
And this is after he had built four different churches. So it's a part of it.
Right.
But essentially, I can remember one thing, and I'm probably very much like him in this sense. He never really used that as his sole primary way to support his family. He always had two jobs, at least, on top of being a minister for all these people, because he never felt as if he should be dependent on the human spirit, which sometimes is very, very shaky and very, very deceptive. Let's call it what it is. Everybody doesn't have the highest calling, and they try to leverage themselves. They try to play the angles. They try to put people in situations that, unfortunately, there are a lot of families that, how can I put it, receive the brunt of people in situations where they can make decisions for their lives. And so my father never wanted to be in that situation, and I pride him in that. And I basically done the same thing, really. I've always had a parallel career throughout my course of even playing music as much as I've played it. I've always done that.
Well, if people actually read the book, if they actually read a Bible, they will see that that is the function of a minister. They are not supposed to be making their living as ministers.
Well, you know,
It's actually in the book.
No, it's very interesting. It's a very interesting thing. Basically, what I got out of it, I can't put it in a nutshell.
Right.
But I will say there's a lot of music and there's a lot of community, real community that I got out of it. And it exposed me to people from all different walks of life and exposed me to a musical repertoire that I think a lot of people don't have. And it exposed me to looking at an example of a man who really felt as if his family was very, very important. And I've tried to be that kind of man myself in my own life. So I guess I got it from somewhere. You know, I didn't just pop up. And
right.
So I got to acknowledge that.
Also started drumming in church, I understand. Oh, okay. So I've been misinformed. Where did you start drumming?
Oh, I started when I was like really, really young, like, you know, 6, 7 years old. Mm-hmm. My mother and father, they paid for lessons for me. And then I went up and I played every kind of music that there was. I played rock and roll, rhythm and blues, regular straight ahead music, bebop. I backed up shows. Then I played free bop. And after that, I had an organ group. in that organ group, we had a singer. And we were playing our society gigs, the Keys, mm-hmm. and all the fraternities and sororities. I mm-hmm. had, you know, that going on. And then I eventually started, after studying the fake book and all the music that's in the fake book and learning, you know, standards and things like that, I had an eye-opening experience in California where I started just playing free music. And I decided at that point I was not going to play anybody else's music. I decided at that point I had reached a place where the way I played was completely different from just straight ahead playing. And for some reason, it just kept coming back to me. And I look at it, Joyce, in the sense of, like, the way I try to explain it is, I actually at one point heard my Earth Mother. And at that point, I started playing differently. And then I moved back to the East Coast. That was on the West Coast. And then I moved to New York and met all the gentlemen I've worked with throughout the years and people like yourself that support the music and love the music and live in our community in New York City. And that's the way it's been. But it started at a very early age, when I was 6 or 7 years old.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't like it at first, Joyce. I hated it.
Yeah, I heard that somewhere. It's like, wow.
Really? Where are you hearing this stuff?
Oh,
anyway,
I have to research.
I hated it. Joyce, my friend's outside playing. They're having fun. I'm in the house practicing.
Oh.
And what does your mother say to you? You know something? I'm paying $10 for you to go and take lessons. You're practicing. Right. That's what you're going to do.
Right.
And then I said, okay, all right, okay, cool. So eventually, though, I grew to love it. And it was just a part of something in my growing up years that I think every child should have. Access to the arts and access to music and how to make a composition and how to get along with all different kinds of people.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, as orchestra is kind of a very, very democratic situation.
Yes.
You don't see a person standing out there and just like, it's all about me. And I liked it, mm-hmm. you know, made friends and stuff.
So you did play in orchestra when you were in school?
Orchestra, band.
Yes.
Yeah, all those things, yeah. Well, that's really way back. I'm not going to go that far back.
Oh, why not?
Well, the reason why, Joy, is sometimes I get confused about history.
Okay.
My wife is much, much better about that kind of thing than I am,
okay.
I got to say. Because sometimes there's so much facts and stuff, you say
right.
to yourself, did that happen that way? Or did that happen? Or was that just something I was dreaming?
But I think for the sake of just sharing the experience of playing with other persons.
Musicians?
Exactly.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll put it this way. I've known and played with many, many different types of people, and I think that the experience of being a musician and an artist enabled me to go to school, and at that point, I was in that situation at like 18 or 19. I went to school, and I paid for my school with it. So that enabled me to get a degree in political science, sociology, and history. And I was not working at McDonald's.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And it was a good thing. I was playing 5 nights a week, and it worked for me. I guess I just had that Gemini kind of curiosity and wanting to just be on the scene and run around crazy half the time, which is cool. For me, it kind of worked. For some people, it might not work. So I'm not advocating that. Don't get me wrong, folks. I'll just say that.
Right.
I had become accustomed to it. So there were a lot of different things going on. And I think that just being around people and meeting all types of people, you know, hustlers and intellectuals and mm-hmm. musicians and scholars and, you know, because you come in contact with all these kind of people when you're playing music. It's a beautiful thing. It really is. It opens up your consciousness to the diversity that we are.
Sure.
And then on top of it, you have the opportunity to give, to be of service to these people, to make these people happy, to deal with the rhythm of life as you're enjoying them as people. I think that that's a worthwhile goal. I think it's a worthwhile journey, and that's been a part of what I've experienced.
Thank you.
Listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl's the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. Our guest for this evening is drummer, poet, composer, and band leader, William Hooker. What you're listening to in the background is Drum Form. It's from William Hooker's debut release as a leader, is Eternal Life. That's a 1977 Reality Unit Concepts release. William Hooker on drums and percussion, David Murray on tenor saxophone, and Mark Miller on bass. Before that, we heard Lower Interlude from the William Hooker Quintet. Channels of Consciousness is the name of that release, and it was recorded at Roulette in Brooklyn. This is a 2012 No Business Records release. William Hooker on drums, spoken word, poetry, and it's a duet with Sangha on percussion. Before that, we heard Coming Home from Alice Coltrane's Lord of Lords, a 1972 Impulse Records release. Alice Coltrane on organ, on other selections. She's on harp, piano, timpani, percussion. She's also the arranger. Charlie Hayden on bass, Ben Riley on drums and percussion. There's a cello section, violin section, and viola section. Many members in those sections. Before that, we heard a snippet from a YouTube video describing the Great Migration, William Hooker's project that's taking place in Roulette on Thursday. Before that, we heard Character from the William Hooker Quintet, another selection from Channels of Consciousness. On this selection, it's Adam Lane on bass, Dave Ross on guitar, Chris DiMiglio on trumpet, and Sangha on percussion. Before that, we had Plenty Time Passed Fast Fast from Cheryl Boyce Taylor in honor of National Poetry Month. That is all of April, coming out of Women's History Month. And we're also celebrating International Jazz Month as well. This is from Cheryl Boyce Taylor's 2004 Mango Pretty release. It was recorded on Cheryl Boyce Taylor's own label. And we opened our show, of course, with our theme from Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, from the very best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. This is an RCA BMG recording, originally recorded in 1967. This is from a 1998 RCA BMG compilation. Stay tuned for our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer Hank Williams, and more from William Hooker, right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl continues. I'm
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for April 1st. This segment features era listings of Sugar and My Bowl guests so you can see them live. And this week's guest is drummer William Hooker. And you can see him at Roulette in Brooklyn on April 5th for his Great Migration project that uses dance, music, visuals, and narratives to tell the story of the African-American Great Migration from the South. And bassist William Parker joins him for that show. And we have more listings for you this week. We start with drummer Billy Cobham, who's at B.B. King's with the Crosswinds Project on April 3rd. Pianist Randy Weston is at the Tribeca Performing Arts Center at Borough of Manhattan Community College on the 3rd for a live interview. Also on the 3rd, vocalist Catherine Russell is at the Jazz Museum in Harlem for an interview with bassist Christian McBride. Guitarist Mary Halverson leads the Code Girl Project at the Jazz Standard from the 3rd through the 4th, and she'll be at the Stone on the 13th and 14th. Guitarist John Schofield is at the Blue Note from the 3rd through the 8th. Drummer Lenny White is at the Village Vanguard with Rini Rosnes from the 3rd through the 8th. Bassist Mimi Jones leads a quartet at Smalls on the 4th. Pianist Randy Weston leads the African Rhythms Quartet at the Jazz Standard from the 5th through the 8th. Pianist Mark Carey's Harlem Sessions returns as Late Night Sets at Smoke on the 6th and the 20th. Looking a little bit further ahead, vibraphonist Roy Ayers is at the Blue Note on the 10th and 11th. Bassist Ron Carter is at the Blue Note from the 12th through the 15th with Michel Legrand's trio, and at the Jazz Standard on the 17th with Ethan Iverson's trio. Saxophonist Billy Harper also joins Ethan Iverson at the Jazz Standard on the 17th. Saxophonist Lakeisha Benjamin is at Ginny's Supper Club in Harlem for an album release party on the 15th. Guitarist Julian Lage is at Les Poissons Rouges with Nels Klein on the 16th. Pianist Harold Mayburn is at Smoke for their 19th anniversary celebration from the 13th through the 15th, and he also leads a trio at Smalls on the 18th. Finally, saxophonist Pharoah Sanders is at Les Poissons Rouges on the 19th. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And Sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. And if you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too, where we'd appreciate your likes, tweets, and shares with your friends. If you like what we do, please help the station stay on the air by pledging whatever you can and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. The support WBAI link on the Sugar in My Bowl website has details, and we're grateful for any help you can give the station. This is Hank Williams signing off with our bi-weekly schedule. We're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and are scheduled to be back on air on Sunday, April 15th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
You're tuned to WBAI, the station that tells our story and tells it like it is. This is Mabel Williams, widow of Robert F. Williams, Negroes with Guns, and you're listening to WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM.
And I mean every word of it.
Thank you.
I came across a phrase where you had mentioned that you were, your family, or you were a member of the Talented Tenth. That would be W.E.B. Du Bois' Talented Tenth.
I would say so.
What does that mean for you in saying that?
All right. Boy, Joyce, you're giving me good questions. I love this. I love this because not that many people have really read the works of W.E.B. Du Bois, Richard Wright, James Baldwin. They mention these people, but I don't think that they actually, Lorraine Hansberry,
right.
Toni Morrison even. They mention these people, but I don't think they've actually read it. Because when you read it, you realize that, what is that phrase? To people who something is given, a lot is expected, something like that.
Uh-huh.
So in my case, my family has a history whereby they came from the South, and everyone that I know that were my father's brothers and sister became very, very important in terms of general society. My uncle, who is the last one now, he has served in four administrations. He was the head of all of welfare of all of the Northeast, and he's still alive now. I couldn't capture his voice for this because I didn't have the tools when I went up to visit him. But he worked under Donna Shalala, and I have had people in my family, most of them, that have been like superintendents of schools, heads of unions, as well as like regular workers. But the point is, my father helped to put all these gentlemen through school, and he would have them all come to our house in Connecticut to live with us while they were going to college. And most of them did go to college. And when I say that Talented Tenth, I'm talking about, and that's not a bourgeois phrase. That's mm-hmm. a phrase I think that is meant to let us realize that if you are given something, especially a talent, or you're placed on this earth because those that have nurtured you loved you enough to make you feel safe in your pursuits of your knowledge in your life, you have something to give back.
Right.
And you can interpret that through the way that you live your life. I mean, through the talent you yourself have. And there are many people that are not that lucky. They have to really seriously scrape from mm-hmm. like, I mean, they scrape it. And I've never had to be in that situation. And even though I went to go see my great-grandfather's places and things, they've always had places. They weren't like on that house on the hill. They were not in that situation, but they always really carried themselves with dignity in their neighborhoods. And they always tried to be as independent as they possibly could, as well as being a part of the neighborhood. And then when I saw the church situation, that was the same kind of thing. Because many people that have this church experience, they realize that in the black community, the church is very, very important. So that's the way I interpret it. I don't interpret it as like one person is better than another, mm-hmm. or people who study poetry are better than people who can make a chair. No, I don't look at it that way. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, as you know, some of these craftspeople, they are creating works of art. There's no right. doubt about that.
Right.
So I look at it just as I was raised in a certain way, and hopefully I'm trying to stick with whatever the honesty is about and the love that my parents gave me so that I can give to others through music or through writing, poetry, or whatever. Maybe it's something that I don't think I've achieved yet, but when people like Train and people like Alice Coltrane talk about selflessness, maybe that's what it's about. Maybe it's reaching that form of consciousness where there's a certain selflessness, and it's not about your ego. It's not about you anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I interpret it. Hopefully we can reinterpret to make them real in a very practical sense for people to have more dignity and for people to realize that there is hope, separate from all this craziness that is going on. Even if there is craziness and you feel as if it's hopeless, you have to keep going. You can't just stop and just say, I'm through. Even if you feel like you're going to lose. So that's another thing I think that's essential.
You mentioned your experience in the church setting. That environment helped people cultivate and move on to whatever they did, and then that person would in turn help somebody else and what have you.
That's part of it. That's part of it. But I also saw this, Joyce, in the hustler setting,
right.
in the bar setting, in the place where you play five nights a week, in a place like the Famous Door, you go in there, the same principles are happening. You're just seeing a different type of person doing the same thing.
That was actually what I was going to ask you about. The different. Tell me about the different spaces where you've also experienced this. I'm also thinking collectives.
Collectives, okay. How can I approach that? I think that any well-run club, when I say club, I'm talking about a place where there's like drinking and dancing and music playing and things like that. Most of the time, that's a cooperative collective. separate from people who are just like putting on concerts and stuff, because you walk in and you're in a situation where people are dependent on each other and trust each other. You could be the bartender, but you're looking out for the waitress, and the waitress is kind of looking out for the musician, and the musician is looking out for the customer. Just like last week, I had a very deep experience, which was a cooperative that many people don't feel it. They don't understand it as a cooperative. I went up to advertise this concert at National Action Network.
Oh, yes. That is a cooperative.
Thank you. It was eye-opening. I was like, what is this? This place is happening. I like this place. And we're talking about the things that are happening throughout the week in terms of our progress and the things we have to deal with. But that's also a cooperative. So I think it takes many different forms. I think that we do accomplish more in a cooperative situation than in a single situation. I believe that. And I do believe that the higher one goes on the spiral that is evolution, I really do believe that more and more cooperation happens, whether we're conscious of it or unconscious of it. I also believe that many of the opportunities that we find ourselves in, talking to people that have very similar ideas, like me talking to you, this happens because of something that's in the universe that just means that we attract each other for this exchange of knowledge and exchange of whatever. And I think that that's part of this cooperative collective spirit. I can't put it any other way other than the fact that I believe in cooperative and collective. I believe in the power of the group. I really do believe it's very important. And just for unity of any type, I think it's essential. Because eventually one realizes it's not just about me.
Thank you.
Another word I guess I would use in addition to cooperative would be institution.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to give you, Joyce, is I'm trying to give you the experiences that I've had that open my eyes to different things,
right,
separate from what people that are just into music are about,
sure,
or separate from what people that are just into politics are about. There is a spirit that permeates all of it, that
exactly
makes it all like one. And then when we connect the dots, we see that they support each other. And it's important, especially in the times we're living in.
So when did you become a poet? I know you've done it for a long time, but what
yeah,
was
very
the
long
thing
time
that
very long time
sparked?
Well, you know, my going to California was eye-opening for me.
Okay.
It was eye-opening because at that time, it was the 70s. It was a way for me to interpret my feelings in a different way that wasn't just music. Because when I went to California, the musicianship, the level of musicianship was different than the level that I left. The East Coast in New York City, I mean, I've been exposed to some pretty heavy hitters, just in terms of just learning about music and what music is. I just didn't just come to this free music just all of a sudden, you know, like, oh, I'm free.
Right.
No,
right.
No, it didn't happen like that. For me, it didn't happen like
right
that. Not that for somebody else, it can't happen like that. Don't get me wrong. Mm. But for me, it didn't happen like that. So I went there with a certain quest. And I also went there with a certain amount of skill and expertise at what I was doing. But it wasn't necessarily used totally the way I wanted it to be used, because where I went, which was the Bay Area, Oakland, San Francisco, Berkeley, the level of musicianship compared to, let's say, New York, Boston, New Jersey, which was like Newark, it was different. So I had to find another method to put my creative energy. And so I just started writing stuff. And after I wrote stuff, then I started, like, looking at it again, which is kind of a process of editing in a way. But also getting used to different forms of people that were writing as well. And that's the way it grew. It just kept growing and growing and growing. So it's just another method for me to just be creative and channel my energy. And that was like in the 70s, and it's continued on.
And your poetry will be part of the migration?
No.
Oh.
I'm using narrative, and the narrative is not the poetry. The
okay
narrative really is certain basic facts that deal with what has happened in terms of why transportation was important, why
okay
cooperative living was important. I'm giving people facts about, and they can take these facts or leave them, but it's important when you look at the way we've transitioned from certain kind of economies to other kind of economies,
right,
and how we bettered ourselves economically, socially, and those kinds of things. Those are parts of the narratives that I am chose to have Jeremy and Gussi speak
right
about. And then you deal with the whole primary narrative, because I'm asking people questions about those kinds of things, and you're hearing it from the horse's mouth about what it's like to be on a train and coming up to a place, and you travel all night and all day, and you find yourself in this place, and what's your first job, and why did you go there, and where did all the black people from Alabama go? And so I'm using that more than anything. And myself, I'm using for the thing that I'm doing the most is really coordinating and directing the music, and directing, like, for lack of another word, the libretto of
got
it. Because it took me a while to really edit it down and get it, because this subject is so massive. I had to deal with certain years. I had to deal with also certain ways that I interpret creativity, because I couldn't just let myself just go out there and just, because you see me play. I go out there and play. I'll play for an hour and 10 minutes nonstop.
True,
that's not
true
what I'm going to do.
Right.
That's not what this is.
Exactly.
Tomorrow it may be that, but not for this one.
Right.
So that's another thing, because if you interpret things that way, then you see that when you go play a regular gig with a trio quartet, it's different than a multidisciplinary piece that you write. I'm just trying to use all the different forms that there are to just be creative and to give. Really, that's kind of what it is.
Is there a plan to record this at any point?
Yes, it will be recorded.
Oh, okay. That evening
it
will
be
recorded?
Yeah, it will be recorded. It will be videotaped.
Okay.
And all those things are in place.
Got it.
That's one great thing about roulette, I
yes
must say. They have people there that really know their stuff, and people that are very, very sensitive to the performances and sensitive to the artists that they're working with. And I can't say enough how grateful I am to be working with the excellent musicians that have given me their time and given me their energy, and a place like Roulette that decided that this is an important piece to really support and to put forth. I got to thank these people for this, because it's a beautiful thing to know you have people behind you like this. It really is. It makes you feel like you're not going crazy. You're okay.
Now, I got a question for you, because to sort of round out this program, I have to fill up 2 hours. And so
I thought this was part one.
This is part one for now. And as part of this part one for now, your recordings.
Okay.
Well, I believe it's in 1974 your release as a leader was first provided. But what made you decide, okay, I'm going to be a leader recording?
When I heard my Earth Mother. Remember I mentioned that to you?
Yes, you did say that. What does that mean, your Earth Mother?
It means in my experience what happened. Mm-hmm. I was in San Francisco.
Right.
And I was playing with a group of people that were all drummers. Mm-hmm. Many people will know some of the people that were in the group that I played with, because it was a group called Juju.
Oh, yes.
message from Mozambique. Juju was on Strata East.
Yes.
That group was created by myself and two other people in San Francisco.
Oh.
If you remember that group, we had three conga drummers. One was playing three drums. The other two were playing two drums. I was playing drum set. And as I said, I heard the sound. And I knew at that point what I had to do in a way. I knew, number one, I had to move back to the East Coast because the sound was so heavy in my spirit that I knew I had to try and find people that could deal with this level of intensity. Secondly, I had started writing my own music, and I wanted to hear this music. And thirdly, I knew that I had a certain drive that enabled me to try and put groups together, realizing that at the forefront of the group, I wanted the drum set. I was not going to deal with this hierarchy of instruments that says that if you play this music, the hierarchy of instruments states very clearly and explicitly, there's saxophone, there's trumpet, there's piano, there's bass, and there's drums. I said, nope, that method is not going to work for me. This whole thing of like rhythm section, all this, that's not going to work for me. It's not going to work for me either in the music, and it's not going to work for me on how it's recorded either. So because of that, I tried to find people that would record me properly, and I tried to find people that would play my music properly. Because if you look at my music, there is no time signature. I don't have a time signature.
Right.
Like 3, 4, 6, 8, whatever.
Right.
I don't have that because I am free to play in any signature I want. That's a stipulation because that's the kind of drumming that I started to actually feel was where I'm coming from. And if you really think about it, Joyce, I'm of that branch of the tree, which includes Milford Graves.
I was just thinking, yes. Exactly.
Rashid Ali. That's my branch of the tree. Even though these other people, they've inspired me. Don't get me wrong. Please, I'll listen to Art Blakey in a minute. But I know what branch of the tree I'm on. That's another thing. I'm not just like coming out here with like, oh, well, I'm a drummer, blah, 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 blah. I realize this whole drum thing, rhythms, this is many, many people have contributed to this. And I'm a contributor. And those people, that's the branch of the tree that I'm on. So I just felt for me to take it to the next level or to continue to contribute, I had to do it in a different way. I had to do it in a way so that you could hear the drums being played, separate from a person's understanding of compression when they record things or all that kind of stuff. I don't adhere to that. I never have. So out of that just came a certain sense of what I wanted. And what can I say, Joyce? I've been very, very honored and lucky to be able to do the things in the way I've done it and with hardly no resources at all. But I knew I had to do it in that way. And for me to be able to do it that way, I dealt with parallel careers.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know what they say? Whoever pays the piper called to tune, usually the piper wasn't there. So that's another reason why I was lucky. Because I was really working all this time. I was working on full-time jobs all this time. So that enabled me a certain independence as well.
Like most ministers.
No. Like most Gemini.
Okay. There's one thing that I wanted to cover.
Huh?
About recording. Like most people who play free music, I've noticed, there is no reliance on radio airplay. And so as a result of that, a lot of the recordings, you play to your heart's content. You explore as far as the exploration will take you. The time for a lot of the selections are lengthy. There are 10 minutes.
Why not?
Exactly.
If I can concentrate that long, I'm expecting everybody else to concentrate that long too.
At the same time, the selections are lengthy, therefore it's difficult to play. Like this particular program, I have to consider which tunes can I play to include the conversation.
I'm with you.
Because the selections are lengthy, I may only be able to play a portion of the selection.
I'm with you.
I guess, that was never something you thought about when you were recording?
Oh, I've always thought about it. I've thought about it to the extent that I have something like maybe, I would say, about 60 recordings as a leader on CDs. And I think that if a person really investigated the entire discography, they find different periods. Many of them are highly edited. I did that specifically so that they would be played. And others, I did specifically because of the concept behind whatever the title is. Like, let's say, myself and Billy Bang, Joy Within.
Yes.
I mention that because I can remember, and many other people can remember too, probably, when Billy Bang and myself hit at the old knitting factory the very first time. We went in there, and that knitting factory came up off of Houston Street. There was really no doubt about it. I said to myself, this dude can play. And he looked at my face and said, this dude can. And you want to take advantage of the fact that you're playing with somebody that can play. And you don't want to minimize that situation. And you want, if it's a live recording, you try to give it as close a semblance of that live experience as you possibly can, even though it's a second experience. So what I've tried to do in many cases is to give people a full dose when I felt it was necessary by either including longer pieces and shorter pieces, including pieces that were energetic as opposed to some pieces that were like just straight out beautiful in terms of, well, it's all beautiful, but I mean contrast. I'm not just this person that just full on, continuously full on. There's a lot of contrast in my music, so I may do one piece that is featured with Sabir Mateen and David Soldier. I may do another piece which features Jason Wang and Roy Campbell. Or I may do another piece which includes just myself and pianist Mark Annan. But it all depends on the situation. That's why when you see something that's called Joy Within, I'm really trying to tell them that story. And then if you see a piece called Heart of the Sun, I'm trying to tell them that story. But I'm trying to tell them that I don't look at it just in terms of airplay. I look at it just as a complete statement that sometimes deserves serious editing. And sometimes I have to give people the full expression of what it is. And I try to use the experiences I've had with the musicians themselves to actually have the person who's interested in investigating this music have the best opportunity to understand it, separate from them being there and seeing the whole performance. So that's the method that I've used. So far, I think it's been okay. But you know something, Joyce? It's very interesting when we're dealing with like this whole streaming thing. And also, there aren't places like WBAI, WKCR, WHUS. When you really listen to the stations, they're just playing the same mainstream music. Mm-hmm. This music is not mainstream.
Right.
And when they accept the fact that it's art and it's not just mainstream, I think they'll look at it in a different way. They'll look at the sales of it in a different way. They'll look at the investment of it in a different way. But that's a long time coming. But maybe that comes in cycles, too. I'm not really sure. The jury is still out on that one.
Tell me about how you did wind up playing with Billy Bang. Was that it? It's like this person can play, and so you just played?
No.
Okay. What's that? Okay.
What happened was the Knitting Factory, who I have like 7 recordings on their label, and I was playing there very frequently. I was one of the main artists that recorded for the Knitting Factory. They were getting ready to send me to Europe to do a tour. And I was sitting here having coffee, probably with my wife, and I was really thinking, who am I going to Europe with? She said, Billy Bang.
Oh!
So I said, wait a minute, what? Where'd that come from? And then she says, yeah, Billy Bang. Did she play with Billy Bang? And I started to think about it. I said, violin and drums. I said, oh, that could be interesting. It was very simple, just like that.
Wow.
I stopped to think about what it would sound like economically, if it would work, how we were going to be in each other's presence for like a lengthy amount of time. And it just so happened that her wisdom told me the right thing to do. It was the right thing to do, and it was because of her.
Wow.
Really.
So did she ever say why Billy Bang?
Well, she's heard me play for the last 45 years.
Okay.
And she knows. She's seen all this from the very beginning in Eternal Life all the way up to the brand new record that's coming out next month. It's called Pillars at the Portal, and it features quintet Anthony Parag.
Guitars.
James Brandon Lewis.
Oh, my goodness. He's been a guest on the show.
John Arabagon.
What does he play?
John Arabagon is also a tenor player.
Okay.
And Luke Stewart.
Oh, yes, bassist.
That's the quintet. Then the recording that just came out is called Remembering. That features Ava Mendoza and Damon Smith. So she's seen music all the way from there, all the way through the entire Knitting Factory period, the Homestead period, Radiation, the Silk Heart, through the No Business period, through all these periods. She's seen all this music.
Uh-huh.
And she's been around this music. She knows who can play. But I mean, I may not necessarily agree with what she has to say, but the point is, when someone says something serious like that, that's what they're thinking. And I really stopped to think about that. And then next thing I knew, I called up Bang. We talked for literally 5 minutes. And it was yes,
okay,
both of us. We didn't have to go through this whole big negotiating thing. You know what I mean? Which is really great when you meet spirits like yourself. You
right,
know, you don't
right.
have to go through this whole, let me explain who I am and what I do and all this. And it was just like, wow, where do we start? When do we start? William, oh man, why? I speak German. Oh, yeah, let's go to Germany. Okay.
Wow.
And so he's looking out for me all this time because he's taking care of things and telling me how to order food. And I mean, you know, this is fun.
Mm-hmm.
This is fun. As well as the fact that he's sitting there reading Barons and I'm doing what I'm doing, writing poetry, reading. It's like,
all right.
You're not just there just like, oh, well, let's just do this gig and let's just go to the next gig and go to the next gig. She gave me a suggestion that included not only one of the greatest violinists on earth, but gave me one of the intellects that I like to be around, that kind of mentality, because it feeds our growth.
Right.
It's important when you're on the road. And you want to go to museums. You want to do things that aren't, I do anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not just like one of these just, oh, go out here and smooze and find out what the next gig is going to be. No,
mm-hmm.
I try to take advantage of the architecture. So that was that type of person.
Beautiful. So this release you mentioned that's coming out next month?
Yes, it will. What's going to happen? This has taken a long, long time to be able to do. I say that because I have a long-running relationship with No Business Records. So I have another thing in the works with them. My things for them come out as well on CD and vinyl. As a matter of fact, they came out with Light.
Oh, yeah, the box set. Okay.
Yes. It's on the Melotta label. It's not only going to be streamed and downloaded, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that there's going to be a certain amount of hard CDs that are made, and I'm just going to try and get as many as I can to the musicians first and then mm-hmm. to people that are going to review it and play it, et cetera. You know, just keep the music going.
Well, hopefully it will also be available by the time the Vision Festival happens in May. Yes?
No, I don't think it will be.
Oh,
I don't think
okay.
it will be. Because for any of this, this is what's interesting about this whole time period thing. I think that what happens, how can I put it? I don't want to have any more CDs than I have in my closets already. That's the first thing.
Okay.
Second thing is, I think that for me to be able to deal with these two releases, we've already gotten 4 really good reviews of Remembering.
Remembering is available, too. I'm looking at sources where it could be obtained to download as MP3 and as physical.
All right, then. See?
Yeah.
That's a good thing. And I think it's good when people write about it, because
mm-hmm.
when they write about it, then more people will know that it exists. I'm just trying to, right now, Joyce, to be honest with you, I am just consumed spiritually and mentally and physically with what has to happen for the migration to be ushered into the world.
Okay.
As a multidisciplinary piece that will happen in universities,
mm-hmm.
that will happen in art centers, that will happen in these kinds of places, and I can do workshops behind it and
mm-hmm.
stuff like that.
Okay.
That's really the main thing I'm really thinking about.
Perfect.
But obviously, you know, I love to play, so we'll just take it slow, ushering it in. There's a lot going on, you know, so I'm just trying to maintain my center and trying to stay healthy.
That's helpful.
And try to take advantage of all of the different things that New York can offer me and just have a positive frame of mind, even though I do realize there are a lot of facts out here that make us feel as if things are really crazy.
Well, thank you for adding to the light that
thank you, Joyce.
For
thank
us.
You.
We look forward to seeing you on Thursday at Roulette
yes.
for the Migration Suite.
Yeah, the Great Migration.
The Great,
the great Migration.
Okay.
Yes, it is. And people can get tickets if they like at roulette.org. And if you could tell them again where this is, I'd appreciate it.
As a matter of fact, I can do it right now. It
okay.
is at 509 Atlantic Avenue. That's
yeah.
where there is transportation that will get you there. You can go to the Atlantic Avenue.
That's right.
In
yep.
Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn, yeah.
And that is Thursday, April 5th. 8 p.m. You can go to roulette.com, roulette.com
right.
for tickets. And
and for all the information as well, because it'll tell them about the people that are going to be there and
exactly.
And the people who are going to be doing the narratives and where they come from, et cetera, et cetera. There's going to be many, many colors in this.
Yes.
Many, many moods in this. There's going to be moods of intense joy. And there's going to be moods of, like, unbelievability. How did this person actually make it? How did this happen?
Oh,
you know,
by the way, the
yeah.
image that's used, well, the images that will be used, where are you getting those?
Oh, I went into Great Migration. I Googled them.
Okay.
And many of them can be used in terms of images that are for, what do you call that, when they just put something up for public consumption.
Creative
or
Commons
public.
For public.
Yes, yeah,
yeah.
yeah.
Okay.
And there
okay.
are many, many of them.
Okay.
Many of them. Cool. These aren't relatives of mine.
Right.
Or anything like that. These are just some of the people that came through.
It also shows what people built things up to become.
Yes. Yes,
out of the rubble.
Becoming dentists.
Yes.
Becoming doctors.
Yes.
The Harlem Renaissance.
Exactly.
It shows many, many things. As I said, I'm covering 1935 to 1950 specifically. Because that period, let's say from 1912 all the way up to 1970, that's a little bit too much. As you know probably, Joyce, I've been doing things with Oscar Michaud.
Yes, yes.
And Oscar Michaud was also a part of the migration. Matter of fact, he lived in New York for about a year, and I found out, and I'm going to be a part of one of the groups that's trying to get in Harlem, along with National Action Network, a street named after Oscar Michaud.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, all these people, Richard Wright,
right,
Lorraine Hansberry, they're all coming out of that.
Sure.
And so I'm excited, and I'm learning, trying to grow.
As am I, and I'm sure I will learn more on Thursday at Roulette.
Joyce, thank you. Thank you so much for having such a great conversation with you.
Thank you.
I really appreciate this. All right, I'll see you soon, okay?
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, bye, thanks.
You're listening to the closing moments of Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones, and our guest for this evening was William Hooker, drummer and organizer for the Great Migration presentation that's taking place at Roulette on Thursday, April 5th at 8 p.m. And you can find out more about getting tickets for this event by going to roulette.org. That's roulette.org. What you're listening to right now is Barriers to Good, selection from Remembering. This is a 2018 Astral Spirits release. William Hooker on drums, Ava Mendoza on guitar, and Damon Smith on bass. Before that, we heard Nairobi Chants from the group Juju. Message from Mozambique is the name of the release. This is a 1973 Strata East recording. It is also available on CD Baby. The personnel includes J. Plunky Branch on percussion. And William Hooker states that he co-found this group, Juju. Unfortunately, it seemed to be erasing him from history in any event. Before that, we heard The Underground Dead from William Hooker. Cross Points, his 2011 No Business Records release. William Hooker on drums, and he's also the composer. Thomas Chapin on alto saxophone. And before that, we heard Never in Doubt, another selection from Remembering, the William Hooker Trio. And before that, we heard our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer, Hank Williams. Stay tuned. La Nueva Alternativa is coming up next, and we're scheduled to come back on April 15th. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Hello. Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.